My name is Kellen McFall, and I'm the host of New Books in Genocide Studies. In a moment, you'll listen to an interview with Andrew Wolford, a sociologist and author of several books about colonial genocides and First Americans or Native Americans in North America. I wanted to take just a moment to tell you that this interview was interrupted due to issues with Skype. And so about half of the way through the interview, the sound will suddenly sound a little bit different. The content shouldn't be effective, nor should your ability to understand the interview. I just wanted to give you a heads up that as the volume level changes, that's why. And you may notice the laughter at the beginning of the interview from outside of the room. Here I'll just say that I taped this on a university campus at Newman where I teach, and a number of undergraduates were just exiting an exam and were apparently pleased what they did. So that explains the laughter. And so we'll go on to the interview, and I hope you enjoy it.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Andrew Wolford to the show. Andrew is a sociologist at the University of Manitoba and a prolific writer and researcher on a variety of fields. Today, we're going to talk in detail about his new book, This Benevolent Experiment, Indigenous Boarding Schools, Genocide and Redress in Canada and the United States. The book is a fascinating analysis of the boarding school system in the U.S. and Canada from a variety of perspectives. But we'll also be talking more briefly about two other works that Andrew has been involved in, starting with an edited collection titled Colonial Genocide in Indigenous North America, published in 2014, and concluding with a brief discussion of a special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research, edited by Andrew and Jeff Benvenuto. I hope I got that name right. Together, I think they offer a comprehensive sense of the state of research on colonial genocide in Canada and the U.S., and as well, a real sense of where the field of genocide studies stands regarding colonial genocides. It promises to be a great, albeit jam-packed, session. So with that, Andrew, welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start by, why don't you say just a little bit of about your background? How did you get to be a sociologist, and how did you get to be an academic?
Well, I grew up on Vancouver Island, which is in the west coast of Canada, and I was involved in human rights-related organizations like Amnesty International. So when I started at university, I was immediately attracted to sociology and particularly to the conceptual tools provided by sociology as a way of understanding one's own place in the world.
So you said Amnesty International. Why did you turn that into a professional interest? What made you decide you wanted to spend your life at least partly studying violence and genocide?
Originally, I started off studying sociology of religion and doing more quantitative-based sociological analysis. And it was late in my degree when I suddenly woke up and realized that I had this area of interest that I hadn't explored and that I could explore academically, that there was a world called genocide studies and human rights related research that was available to me and was a bigger draw to me as something I wanted to invest my time in. So I began slowly looking at issues related to indigenous peoples, but I started off studying with my master's thesis the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, Mexico. And I, at the end of that, was sitting at the edge of the Lacandon jungle in Chiapas, reading some newspapers from home and wondering why I knew nothing about indigenous people in my own country and settler colonialism in my own country.
So one of the things about genocide studies is that it's such an interdisciplinary field or perhaps multidisciplinary field. What do you think sociology brings to that field? What ways does sociology and the practice of sociology, how does sociology approach genocide in a way that's different than other fields?
Sociology certainly provides tools for structural and institutional analysis to understand the place of the individual within these broader patterns of social behavior, which I think is important for adding complexity or texture to some of the more reductive or narrow stories we sometimes tell through vehicles like law, you know, where there's a clear purpose in terms of identifying a perpetrator, identifying intent. Sociology allows us to sort of flesh out some of the complexity of the ways in which the attempted destruction of groups unfolds.
Well, let's turn to the books that we're going to look at. And it's quite an extraordinary outburst of writing and publishing that you've done in the last couple of years. What happened that all of these three pieces all came out within a couple of years?
I was very fortunate to have a year-long sabbatical. And knowing that I was going to have to enter an administrative position at my university, I realized I better pursue these projects that I dreamed of following up. So I worked hard on that sabbatical.
So the first one that appeared is the edited volume, Colonial Genocide in Indigenous North America.
Yes.
It looks like that book emerged from a conference. Is that right?
Yeah, a small workshop we held here at the University of Manitoba, which we partnered with Jeff Benvenuto and Alex Hinton from Rutgers University to organize.
Well, why did you decide that kind of conference was appropriate? What did you want to achieve from it?
Actually, the conversation about it started on a bus in Buenos Aires. We were at a meeting. We're all members of the International Association of Genocide Scholars, and this is the largest association of genocide scholars in the world. And we were visiting the detention sites in Buenos Aires that had been used by the military junta. And we began talking about how, for the first time at this conference, there actually were a couple papers on colonial genocide, which had been, I shouldn't say for the first time, but there had been a fairly small representation of scholars studying this issue in our conferences in the past. And we thought, particularly in North America, we needed to bring together scholars to talk about this, because Australia and other parts of the world had moved much further ahead of North America in terms of thinking about colonial genocide. So we thought it was time for to get together a group of scholars. So we applied for some funding, and quite soon after that, we're ready to host the workshop.
So I know from experience that conferences often get a somewhat disparate variety of papers. What are some of the unifying insights and themes that emerged out of that conference and from the book as a whole?
Well, one of the things we did when we were, we invited people to participate in it. So there wasn't an open call for papers. Instead, we tried to achieve a balance between American and Canadian scholars, scholars who self-identified as Indigenous people, and what we might call settler scholars, and as well as issues, although there was some overlap, and we want people to be dealing with issues related to physical destruction, particularly in the United States, but also questions of cultural destruction. So we tried to get something of a balance there so that there would be some common themes. And we also tried to invite people who weren't necessarily fully immersed in the field of genocide studies. Because as an interdisciplinary field, we wanted to bring different perspectives and voices that often aren't heard within that field. So some of the people, like Robbie Etheridge, who does more ethnohistorical work, brought a very interesting and early American perspective on the issues. And then other people like Tasha Hubbard, who writes about the buffalo. There had been little we had read previous to that, looking at where animals fit into the larger genocide discussion, and particularly in the North American context. We thought that was a crucial paper to have as part of the collection. So I think what comes through in the volume, though, is that this essentially contested notion of genocide is just that, you know, we don't have any agreement amongst the authors about genocide, nor did we try to impose agreement. Mm-hmm. Instead, you know, the frame is that of what are, you know, in what ways are groups destroyed, and what are some of the complexities of the patterns of destruction as they unfold. So, you know, that was an issue that people approached from many different angles.
Your essay in the book is actually, I take the kind of heart of or an early working through of the ideas in the book. So let's turn to this benevolent experiment, recognizing that we may go back and draw some themes from the edited collection. And in this book, you deal specifically with indigenous schools and especially boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada. And for those of the people in the audience who don't know much about this, what are these schools?
Well, these schools, as the title suggests, were an experiment in social engineering that has a long history in North America, with various missionary societies running these sorts of schools as places where they sought to transform indigenous peoples from their indigenous cultures into more European or settler ways of life. But they really become formalized in the late 1900s or become more systematic as there's an effort to implement them in a more widespread manner to capture more indigenous children, to fully transform indigenous societies and indigenous cultures through the schooling of their children, which is the stated objective, that of, you know, resolving the Indian problem through aggressive civilization and assimilation.
So let's start there. You start out with the book in some ways, although it's not in page numbers the first, by talking about the emergence of a common agreement that there was such a thing as an Indian problem. And you talk about this and other things together as a collective action frame.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the Indian problem? And what is a collective action frame? Can't talk today. My apologies. Talked too much this morning. And how does that emerge in the 19th century?
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, the notion of an Indian problem or of, a population within a colonial space as being a problem is an old one. I mean, original mm-hmm. discussions of the Indian problem could be traced back to India proper, but this language is imported to North America to refer to those peoples misidentified as Indians, the indigenous peoples of North America. And originally, the indigenous peoples were not perceived as a problem. They were allies and important parts of a symbiotic relationship based around, you know, fur trade, military alliances, and other aspects of the initial contact period, whereby particularly, you know, the fur traders relied heavily upon indigenous peoples in order to run their businesses, and the indigenous peoples profited off those relationships through trade. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were problems, obviously. This is a simplification, but it was not a time when indigenous population was perceived as a direct problem. But as settlement became the focus in North America, and as, you know, British in particular were able to assert their control more fully on the continent, and as certain resources upon which indigenous peoples relied, like the buffalo, became depleted, there was a perception that indigenous people represented a problem or a barrier to settlement, that whether it was in terms of building the nation and establishing national sovereignty, or whether it was their claims upon the land, which the settlers had a competing claim to, or felt they had a competing claim to, these were perceived as, you know, problems as in the form of an obstacle to European intentions here. So I think it's important as a collective action frame. Now, the Indian problem, I should also step back a little bit and say that there were different understandings of what the solution to this problem was. Mm-hmm. You have debates going on about whether indigenous people can be assimilated and to become like Europeans, or whether they are too backward, too primitive, using the racist language of the time, whether they were too backward and primitive to ever actually emerge from their quote-unquote savage state. So you have a variety of solutions coming from different places within society, whether it's from the scientific community, the religious community, the military, the government, different actors in different positions who see this problem differently and see the solution to it. But they begin to come together under what I refer to as a collective action frame. You know, often in genocide, we begin by just talking about intent, as though intent mm-hmm. just exists within the individual, that we are, you know, almost isolated units who fashion intent out of nothing. But where we fashion that intent out of, I think, is a broader, more important question that sociologists can contribute to. And the notion of collection action frames, which comes out of the sociology of social movements, provides a way of thinking about the way groups of people begin to think about problems in the same way, to understand their world in the same way. So having that action frame, you know, it literally frames the way you see the world, directs your action, helps you formulate intent, helps you formulate motives for your action. So these larger discussions where I begin, I see as sort of the basic tools, the resources that people have available to them as they start to think about, I mean, I'm talking about settlers in particular, as they start to think about the indigenous people in their midst.
So you took us almost up to this point. How is it that, assimilative schooling becomes a kind of broadly accepted and widely applied response to this perceived Indian problem?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple reasons that seem to emerge. You know, there's these interesting reports that are coming from men who are soldiers who are fighting in the Indian wars, but they also are using the tools of economics to assess what they're doing in warfare, and they're looking at the costs of the Indian wars in the United States. And these sorts of reports have wide influence on how people perceive the quote-unquote Indian problem. Because you know, the logic is that it costs more to quote kill an Indian than it does to educate him, and so there's an economics to it that pushes people. There's also a reformist movement of people who are generally aghast of hearing the stories of the horrors of battles that are taking place in massacres that are occurring against indigenous communities, and indigenous people are coming to eastern towns to tell about their experiences and what's happened to their families, and reformers are calling for a different approach. What's interesting, I mean, these people are in a way liberal and progressive for their times, but they're not necessarily breaking out of the framework of the Indian problem. They're still seeing indigenous peoples and their communities as problems, as backwards, as primitive, but they're looking for a more humanitarian approach to eliminating this problem. So, it's at this point that Lieutenant Richard Pratt in Fort Marion in Florida, who's running a prison for captured warriors from the Indian Wars, begins using the tools of education to try to work with his prisoners who are suffering under the isolating and austere conditions of the prison. So he finds through education and through military training, he's able to seemingly transform these individuals. And he's a great self-promoter. He begins marching them through town, calling in all sorts of reformers who are taken by his self-display of these people. And he begins to build support for developing the first industrial style boarding school. And of course, Canada, where the Indian war, knowledge of the Indian wars had passed over to Canada, because of course you even had indigenous from the groups from the U.S. escaping into Canada, and some also battles taking place on the prairies in Canada, but nothing to the extent that happened in the U.S. But still, Pratt's experiment gains attention in Canada, where schooling has been used in the past and has been recommended in the past. So they begin to look more at the U.S. model to see how they can more systematically use schooling as a way to deal with this problem without the costs, without the horrors of, the more physical eliminatory methods.
So how, and I want to get back in a moment to the variety of levels in which you through which you examine this issue, but for now let's stick at the macro level. How did these policies evolve over time, and what are some of the commonalities and differences in the approaches of Canada and the U.S.?
Yeah, it's interesting to see in the U.S. how there seems to be greater change and less. Mm-hmm. The policy is less static than it is in Canada. In Canada, the notion of the Indian problem, I mean, it remains, traces of it remain even in discourses around Indigenous policy today. But, in its strongest form, where, assimilation is aggressive assimilation is the goal, lasts for a very long period in Canada with little changes, little diversity. The same group of people run Indian affairs in Canada for a long time, and there's a standoff, because one key difference you have to remember in Canada is when Canada implemented its system of Indigenous boarding schools, rather than doing it through the state, through government offices, they saw the missionary societies that were located within these communities as a resource that they should tap into to make it more feasible within the Canadian context, given how the great distance between some of the Indigenous communities mm-hmm. and their distance from city centers. They saw the missionary societies as a useful intermediary for delivering assimilative education. So the schools are set up not by the government, but rather by missionary societies from the Catholic Church or from various Protestant churches. And so this setup then, with these churches controlling the schools and the government controlling the purse strings, also leads to a lot of stagnancy and in the policy, because the two are always sort of sawing each other off when it comes to making any changes. So even when the government wants to implement changes that they think will be more efficient or more effective or won't look so poorly in terms of what's being reported in terms of the harms happening at the schools, often they'll meet resistance from the churches who want to run things in a certain way, and vice versa. The two sort of are at a stalemate with one another. Whereas in the U.S., given that the institutional structure is mostly located within the government, the schools change a little bit as the fashions of government change over the years.
So one of the things, one of the really interesting things about this book is that you do have a policy discussion, and when I say policy, I guess it's kind of the standard understanding of policy at the macro level, at the government, the federal or regional level. But you also look at it, and the sociological terms, as I understand them, are at the meso or micro levels. And so could you say something a little bit about why you decided you need to look from all of those perspectives? And then why you settled on this really interesting metaphor, the settler-colonial mesh, as a way of linking these together and helping explain how all of this works.
The lessons of genocide studies, and I take from other, historians, sociologists, and other people who have worked on other case studies, is, how the policy level only tells you so much. Policy has to be implemented and then enacted on the ground. And funny things happen as you go through this chain from the macro, where policy is envisioned and circulates and provides, discourses or ways for which people to think about these ideas. As you move through the attempt to institutionalize and organize it and implement the policy and then have actual actors embody and live this policy, there's a lot of variety and a lot of unevenness. And I wanted a way to try to understand that unevenness. So without necessarily seeming to dilute what I see as the seriousness of what's going on here, this experiment that's really meant to eliminate indigenous communities so that they're no longer indigenous communities to destroy cultures. So, in this way, there's space for individual actors who maybe refuse to follow the policy line. There's space for intensifications or people going beyond the call of duty in terms of implementing the policy for harsher applications of it. And this is where I like the notion of the settler colonial mesh, because if we think in terms of networks, and really what you have at the macro, meso, and micro levels are various forms of networks at the policy. You have networks amongst various different policymakers and the people who are influencing the policymakers. You have networks between the various institutions that are charged with implementing the policies, and nets overlaying nets overlaying nets. You get a mesh. And what can happen with a mesh is it can tighten around certain places. Say you have a superintendent or principal of a school who themselves is a very militant believer in assimilation. They might introduce more harshness to that environment than exists in another. So in one place, you might have a tightening of that mesh, whereas another supervisor may be far more liberally minded, may have a great appreciation for indigenous culture and allow it to slip into the school in ways that other supervisors wouldn't. So there you might have gaps opening up in the mesh where there's more possibility for resistance, for subversion of the policy, or for the survival of indigenous cultures. So it allows one to think of genocide not simply as absolute destruction, but as a complex process in which, sometimes resistance and survival is possible due to a particular set of conditions, where in other places, in our other regions or other time periods, it may not be possible just because of the tightness of that net. So it's a way to deal with unevenness in across space and across time.
We've spent so far most of the interview talking about the macro level and policy, but much of the book is actually about looking at individual schools and looking at the dynamics at the individual school level. So Andrew, could you say a little bit about how you chose the schools you did and why you thought it was important to look at individual schools?
Sure. Well, I chose the schools. Basically, I was looking for schools that were located relatively close to larger indigenous communities. So that was as much as I was looking for some sort of comparability. I didn't want to focus on finding an analog for Canadian schools in the U.S. because part of my project is mapping the differences, how different regions can have different experiences based upon the confluence of factors that take place that are existing within that region. So to get those regional dynamics, it wasn't crucial to have too many levels of similarity as we may sometimes do in comparative research. So I was really interested by the schools in New Mexico, and particularly the Pueblo experience, because the Pueblo seemed to have a very distinct experience, both historically within the United States and also in relation to their school with the levels of power they amassed in order to be able to influence things that happened within that school. So I thought that was really an interesting case, and also contrasted well with the Diné and the Apache communities that were in the same region, some of their more negative experiences of schooling and the way in which schooling was imposed upon them. Not to say that it wasn't negative for many Pueblo students as well, but the communities had different levels of power that they were able to amass in terms of influencing how the schools operated upon in their communities. And I was located in Manitoba, so of course, the Manitoba schools had a particular appeal to me, and Fort Alexander in particular, knowing several survivors and working with several survivors from that school. I was familiar with their experiences and wanted to look into that case more. So that was the rationale, and I thought it was very important to look locally for, just the risk of repeating myself, find out how different things happen at different schools. It's all well and good to look at the macro level and to do these cross-national comparisons, but based upon the existing literature, I had a good sense that, things at the policy level don't always play out the way they're expected at the local level. And those local differences, I thought, would bring more richness to the text. Our understanding of the ways in which these processes intended to destroy Indigenous groups unfold in practice and not just in theory.
If our listeners who are not experts of this, if they think about these schools at all, what they've probably heard about is stories of physical and perhaps sexual abuse and violence. How prevalent was this, and to what degree was this kind of an intentional policy approach to assimilating the Indigenous peoples, and to what degree was it just kind of individual behaviors of individual people?
Certainly there was a great deal of the latter. And now in the Canadian system, there was, where you see the churches and the state playing their role is in turning a blind eye to the abuse, not recording it, sanitizing the records so that the abuse was not recorded. But through vehicles like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, we are now learning how frequent physical and sexual abuse was at the school. I mean, the group of survivors I work with to a person were sexually abused almost to a person at the schools, and all experienced some forms of physical violence there as well. So it was quite prevalent, particularly at certain schools. And this is where local distinctions matter, because it may have been prevalent at certain schools, but less prevalent at others, where other factors may have intervened to not create the environment where that sort of violence was permissible. In the U.S., we know a lot less about. I mean, there's certain schools where there are people on record who have came forward and recounted their stories of physical and sexual abuse, but there hasn't been the same discursive opening in the United States to allow survivors to come forward and tell those stories safely without fear of denial, without fear of questioning. So I think there's little sense about how extensive this was throughout the system. Certainly physical violence in the early years of the U.S. system you can see as being quite prominent, even despite government efforts to tone down some of the violence. But you had a lot of ex-military people who were running the schools, a very militaristic atmosphere within the schools. The guardhouse was sort of the place of punishment within the school. So there you can get a better sense of, the amount of violence. And then, in the diary of one of the superintendents of the Santa Fe Indian School, for example, he would speak about wearing out his buggy whips on children who were, seen as transgressing the rules of the school. So, this was quite frequent. Violence can play a role in, of course, submitting and demonstrating the power of the colonial institution, the power of the full control over the student's life, to sort of create a more docile subject who can be then shaped to
fit the European standard. That was the, you know, which was the idealized outcome for these schools. You know, that said, I don't focus as much on the violence because,
right.
as you know, it is more well known, and I'm quite interested in the more everyday aspects of cultural destruction, of ways in which different techniques and strategies were used to more subtly shift people away from one cultural orientation, an indigenous cultural orientation, toward a westernized cultural orientation.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. And I guess there's not a chance in a brief interview like this to talk about all of the things you talk about, but I was really struck by your discussion of knowledge as an aspect of the application of policy. Can you say a little bit about how these schools used knowledge in this effort?
Yeah, I mean, it comes in various ways, and the systems of knowledge gathering increases, or they improve over time as further power is asserted over indigenous communities. So, for those of your listeners who are familiar with the work of Michel Foucault, they can probably see a classic Foucauldian idea of knowledge power in play here, whereby you know, the more power one has, the more knowledge one can access, and the more knowledge one has about a population, a subject population, the more you can impose power upon them. And you see that playing out quite clearly in the residential and boarding schools for indigenous people. You know, in the early days, the knowledge gained was just simply gaining knowledge about who these children were, where they came from, did they have any brothers and sisters who were not yet in school. Because, you know, in the very early days of the rest of the boarding school system, they had little knowledge, they didn't have a census to go by, any sort of understanding of how many children were actually out there, which they needed to know in terms of if this was going to be a systematic process of, you know, cultural transformation. They needed this information, so they would be gathering that. But more and more, they started to gather information about the parents as well, and their in Canada in particular, it was important to know what church the parents were affiliated with, especially after 1920 when the Indian Act was amended to specify that the children, parents belonging to a particular religious community, their children were automatically to go to the schools from that religious community. So they wanted information from the parents and also about, you know, what kind of work the parents were doing, you know, and health information was of great concern, particularly as they became more aware that if they didn't screen for various diseases as the children came in, then they would be in danger of importing deadly diseases into the schools. And that's one of the ways in which these schools were most destructive, physically destructive, was through mass disease spread. I haven't talked a lot about the physical destruction, the death within the schools, but disease spread through poor conditions within the schools and through negligent healthcare practices was certainly an issue through various periods of the schooling. But keeping on the topic of knowledge, I mean, the net of knowledge extends as the system goes on, where they start tracking the students after their schooling more and more as well to find out, are they indeed assimilating? Are they being emissaries for civilization as they return to their communities? Are they bringing the dispositions of civilization to their communities? And are they keeping watch on each other? Are they surveilling each other? Are they reporting on their friends when their friends break from civilized patterns of life? So it becomes a much wider net of knowledge gathering as the system goes on, as they start tracking more meticulously all of their expenses, how much is going in, how much is being paid per student, what is the student's progress, how does the student appear when they came in, and how are they, as they leave the school, trying to both demonstrate the schools as effective institutions of cultural transformation, but also to ensure that the work they do upon the students is sustainable and not simply fleeting as the students leave the school.
So in other places in the book, you talk about discipline and desire, and I won't ask you about that here, although I would, you know, if people are interested in this outside. I think it's an outstanding explanation. But I want to ask you about something different. You include an entire chapter on non-human actors. Could you talk a little bit about what you mean by non-human actors and why you thought it was important to talk about them, and maybe pick one space or time or something, and maybe briefly sketch out how this particular non-human actor played a role?
Yeah, I think we tend to be overly human-centric in genocide studies. We tend to think of humans as, you know, the sole constituent of the group. And, you know, in indigenous communities, more and more I've interacted with indigenous people in indigenous communities, you know, that sort of bias, that European assumption of mine has been challenged. And again, I'd point back to Tasha Hubbard's chapter in the Colonial Genocide in Indigenous North America volume as an example of this. You know, various peoples, you know, for many indigenous peoples, their territory is not just something that's instrumental for the group, something that they use in order to sustain themselves. It is actually part of their self-definition. It's their relationships with territory are part of the group relations that make the continuing existence of their group possible. So I thought it was important to understand, you know, from effort to move towards a more decolonizing perspective, I thought it was important to include non-human actors, given their often crucial place in indigenous ontologies. But I also thought, you know, there's a lot of attempt by schooling personnel to enlist various forms of non-human actors in order to advance the assimilative process, and the non-human actors don't always respond in the way they are expected. So space, diseases, time, you know, all these things that are enlisted in a way to try to deal with indigenous populations do not always respond to our efforts to control them. So, you know, space is an interesting one because it plays many different roles. Like the space of the school is very carefully designed for purposes of control. At the Fort Alexander School, for example, in the Saguin First Nation, you know, there's a fence outside the school that separates the school from the community, and people can actually see their family members walking by outside that fence, but unable to get in. And there's even barbed wire on parts of the fence and a large gate that closes to keep the community out. And past that point, you have cultivated land, landscape land, and then the largest building on the reserve is the school. So it stands, you know, in a very imposing way above all the smaller houses that are in the community, sort of as a symbol of European power. And then the classrooms are organized in a way that, you know, students can be, have their movements coordinated, particularly with the separation of boys and girls. So boys and girls are seldom kept able to be in contact with one another. Brothers and sisters who are at the same school rarely see each other and almost never talk to one another within the school. So there's an attempt to coordinate space, but at the same time, space is used to resist. The students always do find spaces where they can sneak away and practice their indigenous languages that they're forbidden to use. They find places to steal stuff from the kitchen and to hide potatoes that they'll later cook in the fire or in the boiler room in order to add to their food, because they're all hungry. They're all, you know, many of them are starving within the school. And, you know, they find creative ways to use space, but space also factors in outside the school as the communities where they know the local space better. They use that space to hide their children, to not bring them to the school. And, you know, particularly you see in Navajo Diné territory, an effort to build roads to expand access into that community, but the territory is for many years used to resist, so that fewer Diné children are sent to schools like Santa Fe and Albuquerque than Yom and other indigenous groups in the area. So space too can be used to resist. So it's I found it quite interesting to try to understand the diverse ways in which these non-human actors intervene into the human relationships that are occurring locally around a particular school.
So I know that you've got another appointment coming up, and we've maybe got 4 minutes left. And so I know that you won't be able to fully flesh this answer out, but you do talk really carefully and thoughtfully in the text, as well as in the edited volume, about the nature of genocide and why it is appropriate to use the word genocide in this case. So could you perhaps try fairly succinctly to talk about why you think that's the appropriate label?
Yeah, I think, first off, I think it's important to understand that I come at the term genocide from a sociological perspective. I do, read case law and the law on genocide. I am familiar with that aspect, but as much as I see contemporary lawyers and judges working at tribunals, modern-day genocide tribunals, seeking to aspire towards a more complex sociological understanding of the phenomena of genocide, I still find law to be reductive when we're trying to understand the nature of groups. As a sociologist, I'm interested in how groups sustain themselves and survive. And I understand genocide in the tradition of Raphael Lemkin, the originator of the term genocide. I understand genocide to be about the protection of the life of groups, not about the life of masses of individuals, but the life of groups. And as a sociologist, I understand groups to be sets of relations. And these relations are what makes group life possible. And these relations are often defined by something we call culture. Culture, which is not necessarily something that's frozen in time, something that moves, something that changes, something that shifts, but still provides people a store of meaning, of knowledge, of traditions, of language, of all these things that allow the group to recreate itself on a day-to-day basis. So that is my interest in ways in which our intergroup relations then, especially when you have disparities of power, how these intergroup relations can cause the severing of the relationships within a particular group. So when you understand the group as a sociological entity, you understand its potential for destruction, not just to lie in physical destruction or attempts at biological destruction through preventing births within the group, but also to lie within efforts to sever those relationships between members of the group. And this is what clearly happens through vehicles like boarding schools, where children are removed from their families for most of the year. They are taught to despise their families, to denigrate their cultures, to go back to their communities, and they see everything as being filthy, as being dirty, seeing their parents as being backward, as being primitive. In some cases, being told not even to think of their parents as parents anymore, and to see the school, the principals, the teachers as their new family. So they're being socialized into a new family environment, removed from these families. I mean, those sorts of attempts to break up human relations are devastating to groups and make it very hard for groups to ever reconstitute themselves in the way that they would more normally if allowed to continue their relations. I mean, the interesting thing about groups are never static, they're never stuck in time, but they do tend to persist in their own ways through the tools of culture. Through these relations, and efforts to interrupt these relations can be similarly devastating to the sustainability of those groups as would be destroying a large number of group members. So, working in the Natural Lemkin tradition, I'm trying to sort of recover what he saw as kind of as a crucial aspect of the concept of genocide when he was attending the United Nations Genocide Convention, the talks that led to the development of the United Nations Genocide Convention. He was quite upset that the nations of the world diluted his concept and took out the notion of cultural genocide, which he had included as Article 3 within an earlier draft. But he, you know, saw the notion of genocide as so important that he didn't want to see this progress stopped for the sake of cultural genocide. But he was, in his memoirs, he, you know, notes he felt was to be quite a loss.
But it's been a fascinating discussion, and I would love to be able to unpack some of these ideas more for you with you and to talk about the special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research. I know you've got to go, so we won't do that. But I would encourage the listeners to go and find the books and find the issue and read them. I've really found them fascinating and in some ways have started rethinking what I think about genocide based on the readings. So Andrew, thank you so much. And I hope that as you continue researching these things and as you continue to publish sometime, you'll come back on the show and talk to us some more.
I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for talking to me.
You've been listening to an interview with Andrew Wolford, author of This Benevolent Experiment, Indigenous Boarding Schools, Genocide and Redress in Canada and the United States, and co-editor of Colonial Genocide in Indigenous North America. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join me next time when I interview Stefan Irisch, author of Justifying Genocide, Germany and the Armenians from Bismarck to Hitler. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.